You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Students around the country are set to return to classrooms over the next month, and there's a lot of concern about whether enough teachers will be there too. We've been talking about teacher shortages for years, but current levels have been causing some news outlets to use words like catastrophic and crisis to describe them in districts in Wisconsin and around the country. What's causing this problem? What solutions are there? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing this in your school? If you work for a school district, is it a homestretch scramble to make sure there's enough teachers to teach the kids when school opens up? Are you a parent or guardian of a student who's affected by a shortage of teachers, students out there? Was this a problem you saw last year? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you were a teacher and you left the profession maybe earlier than planned, love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Tim Slecker is Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University in Ohio. He was formerly with Edgewood College in Madison. He's the host of Busted Pencils Public Education Podcast. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me back.
I remember from past conversations, you don't like the phrase teacher shortage. You say there's more going on behind that. What are you seeing now?
Just an acceleration of what I talked about was it 2019 when you and I talked the first time? It's a leaving, it's an exodus. And on this side, too, the number of people who want to become teachers is declining in a rate that should be incredibly alarming. And I think really alarming at this point to talk about parents, what are you thinking about? Are the people in front of your children, are they teachers, or are they at this moment in time going to just be responsible adults that hopefully will provide safety? And Rob, that's the difference I think we want to talk about, because the shortage solutions right now that we're putting out there, they're not teacher shortage solutions. They're responsible adults that can provide safety while there are no teachers available to teach.
Right. That's some states around the country have done things like saying, okay, military veterans, they can become teachers without the usual certification, or we're going to shorten the length of teacher certification or allow people to teach who haven't quite gotten there yet. What do you see as the shortcomings of that sort of, I guess, Band-Aid approach?
Well, that's what I said, I think we could be honest. If we're honest about this, and first of all, say this isn't a teacher. When I'm taking a honorably discharged veteran that did wonderful things by America and then putting them into a classroom, we're putting them in there for the responsibility and the possibility that they're going to provide some safety, some guidance, some supervision for kids while we're trying to get teachers, because there aren't teachers available. So you don't solve the teacher shortage by bringing people in and calling them teachers. You have to actually get teachers. In the meantime, we have to be responsible for the children, though, and say, here are responsible adults that can provide safety and supervision while we take what we can do and try to get the teachers that your kids deserve.
Okay, so, but why are we short on, you know, the trained teachers right now?
Okay, so why are we short on, now you go back to the conditions in the classroom. And I would say for, you know, over the years, you know, there's a lot of assault that's been dropped on teachers. It's a hard job to do. Anyway, pay is not the way it should be. But most important is that understand teachers. The majority of teachers got into this profession to change lives, to make a difference, to be a mentor, to be a coach, to be this wonderful person. The conditions in the classroom have taken teachers to the point of going, they can't teach, they can't make a difference. So that agency, the professional responsibility, the ability to stand up and do what's best for kids, more teachers realize now the ability to do that, to make a difference in the lives of kids, has been really stripped away from them, whether it's by the society, the culture, or even just really bad education reforms that have largely been responsible over the last few years, particularly accountability and testing, has done everything to erode the profession.
Talking to Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University in Ohio, formerly here in Wisconsin, talking about a big shortage of teachers in districts around Wisconsin, around the country, what to do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you are a teacher, if you were a teacher. What do you think is driving this? Are you seeing this problem in your school, whether you work there, whether you're a student there, whether you're a parent of a student there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Tim, how much did the pandemic contribute to this? I know a lot of, especially older educators who might have thought they had a few more years in them, thought, do I expose myself to this extra health risk by sticking around for those few years?
Yeah, the pandemic is an accelerant to the dumpster fire that was already going on with the teacher exodus. You know, you think about early in the pandemic, there was a moment where, you know, teachers showed up when classrooms were closed. They did, you know, Zoom. They provided Wi-Fi. They were delivering food to children that weren't able to get food in school. You know, for a moment, we saw teachers as heroes. But quickly after, though, right away, when teachers started to actually talk about the health risks for themselves, they got lumped into that kind of alarmist category of not wanting to be there for the kids. And so, yeah, after 2 years of teaching during a pandemic, whether it's lockdown, mask on, mask off, being told constantly that you're a threat to children. And now the new push that all of a sudden we now think that teachers, by teaching appropriate content such as the past, history, slavery, teaching sexual education appropriately, grade developmentally, has somehow been turned into critical theorist Marxist groomers. Of course, why is anybody teaching? So pandemic and culture wars, why are we surprised this is catastrophic?
Yeah, we heard from Aaron and Lake Hallie, who called, couldn't stay online. Aaron says a big problem is how teachers are being portrayed in the media as spreading, as you're just mentioning, critical race theory, for example. Aaron went on, a lot of teachers are afraid of losing their jobs for being LGBTQ allies. How big a factor, you just mentioned that, Tim, how big a factor do you see that for teachers as we head into the school year?
It's a huge issue. Just think about what you just said here. The idea, and in fact, I just read this here in an article in Ohio, a school district here that has had over the last 15 years, a diversity day, a tribute to diversity, has been canceled now because of the threat that that diversity day was actually a grooming event for critical theorists, which has everything so backwards. Celebrating the fact 15 years of progress of allying and being there for diverse students. And then you're talking about LGBTQ, the fact that I have a rainbow on my door that says this is a safe space. Now that a teacher can be targeted as saying you're somehow doing something inappropriate by protecting and guarding the lives of all children. That's the kind of crazy where teachers are saying, I know what's best. It's best to protect every kid, to do what I can. I'm now being yelled at for providing the best safe space, best education for all of my children. How in the world do you expect me to go on being a teacher when I can't even do this bare minimum of keeping my kids safe?
Tim, you've given us a long list of things that might be driving teachers out of the profession or preventing new teachers from getting into it in the first place. Do you see plausible solutions to turn any of that around over the next, I don't know, year?
Whether a year or not, I think first thing is to recognize too that the solutions of getting emergency people in there, if we start to be honest and say that these aren't teachers, these are people that are providing safety and support, then we can do this. And then we address why don't we have teachers. And I think some of the models of looking at of growing your own teachers, looking at people who live in the community who have a vested interest in there, and being a part of the community so that parents can reimagine that those teachers who they absolutely value for those kids are their responsibility. Too many people believe that the teacher shortage is affecting the street down the school down the road and not their own. Parents right now, when parents want really great teachers, we can do that through grow your own approaches, residency, 1 year residency models, teacher preparation institutions, combining partnerships with K-12 and the community. This is a community service project that everybody can get behind because this is what makes thriving communities.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
You got it, Rob. Thank you.
That's Tim Slecker, Director of Educator Preparation Programs at Muskingum University in Ohio. We talked to them about an escalating problem with recruiting and retaining teachers as being felt in Wisconsin and nationwide. Coming up, we'll take a closer look at the problem and some efforts to solve it here in Wisconsin. And you can still join in at 800-642-1234. What is going on in your local school district? Whether you work at a school, used to work at a school. You're a student. You're a parent. What are you seeing going on when it comes to bringing people into the profession, keeping them there? If you have been a teacher and left the profession, what drove you out? If you're staying, what are you trying to balance there? Did you think about going into teacher school? What made you decide to do it or not to do it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about teacher shortages in districts around the state and the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you experiencing this in your district right now? Call in at 800-642-1234. If you work in schools, if you've worked in schools, what are you seeing right now? What kind of challenges are there in keeping people on the job or bringing new people into it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Diana Hess is Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education. Diana, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
What are you hearing from districts around the country? I've seen individual reports here and there. What is your general impression of a potential teacher shortage in the state?
Well, I think the teacher shortage is nationwide, and I think it's really serious in Wisconsin. It has been a problem in Wisconsin for a number of years. But as Tim was suggesting, it's been made much worse by the pandemic.
I want to make sure we talk about this. You have an effort in your education school to try to bring people in and to make sure they work at schools in Wisconsin. Can you tell us about the Wisconsin Teacher Pledge?
Sure. This Wisconsin Teacher Pledge started in August of 2020. We were able to raise money from private donors to create a program where all of the students in our teacher education programs are offered free tuition and testing fees if they pledge to stay in Wisconsin to teach for either 3 or 4 years. So kind of the tagline for the program is, we pledge to pay if they pledge to stay.
And those teachers will be getting into the schools, I guess, in a few years. Do you see shorter term solutions that might help with, fall 2022?
Well, actually, we do have teacher pledge students who are already in the schools. There are over 100 teacher pledge students who finished their first year of teaching. And we had them all here for a summer institute last week. And there are well over 100 additional teachers who will be starting this fall. So we're happy that this program is taking effect very, very quickly. And we're studying it because we're trying to figure out whether or not this is an approach that will work to bring more people into teaching, to keep them in Wisconsin, and to keep them teaching for long enough that they get over the challenges that are so extreme in your first year or two of teaching.
Do you see people, Diana, being more reluctant to go into education in the first place?
Well, absolutely. If we look at teacher education numbers across the country, they are down rather dramatically. One of the reasons we created the Teacher Pledge was to see whether or not lowering the financial barriers to going into teaching would cause more people to want to go into teaching. And so far, it's working. We've got a much bigger class coming in this fall than we've had in the past. And when we just looked at the number of students who are admitted to UW-Madison in this year's freshman class, who say they want to go into elementary education, which they would start as juniors, that number is up 40%. So I actually think that programs like the Teacher Pledge that provides financial support for people to go into teaching can act as an incentive.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Frank is calling from on the road. Frank, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about, Frank?
Well, I taught out here in the suburbs from 1977 till 2011. I kind of was forced to retire because of Act 10, which took power away from the teachers' unions. Now, what was bad about that was that oftentimes in my first 34 years of teaching, since then I've also done long-term subbing, I would say to the old teachers, why am I doing this? And they would say, Frank, the pension is great. Hang in there. Then the unions negotiated, and we had a really nice retirement package that if I retired, like let's say at 58, I retired, I would get 7 years of health insurance, a bridge between retirement and Medicare. But now, if you're a teacher, and let's say you've been teaching 20 years, you're in your 40s, and you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's just another thing that makes teaching more and more of a burden.
Frank, I gotcha. Frank, Diana, we haven't mentioned Act 10 yet. How big? This is it's been 11 years now since that public union law affected teachers in particular. How big a factor do you see that?
Well, I think Act 10 did have a negative effect. We know that in the year after Act 10, a lot of people left teachings, many, many more than had left the year before. But Act 10 can't be the major cause of why we have a teacher shortage in Wisconsin, because this is a nationwide problem. And, you know, Act 10 was unique to Wisconsin. I do think one of the things that happened as a consequence of Act 10 is that teacher pay went down, especially because the amount of money they had to pay for benefits went up. And I do think that teacher pay is a major reason why people leave teaching. I mean, I've talked to a number of new teachers, and they like teaching, they want to stay in teaching, but they can't afford to stay in teaching because they're simply not making enough money. So one of the reasons, again, we created the teacher pledge was so students wouldn't have burdensome student loans. Because if they had those, that would effectively lower their standard of living. But I do think as a state, we'd need to be worried about how low teacher pay is.
We're talking to Diana Hess, Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education, looking at teacher shortages in Wisconsin and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to AJ in Madison. AJ, hi.
Yes, I was just wondering, for those of us who are in our 50s and who have a strong career background, who want to become a teacher, how do we take advantage of the program that Dean Hess was talking about?
Oh, interesting, AJ. Thanks for the call, Diana.
Well, AJ, we would welcome you to apply to one of our teacher education programs. We have programs for people who do not have a bachelor's degree. We've got programs for people who already have a bachelor's degree who want to come in and be prepared to teach special education or middle school or high school in science, math, or social studies or English. So we are really welcoming people to come back after they've had other careers. And we have a number of people in our teacher education programs who are doing just that. We have one student who recently graduated. He's going to be a high school science teacher, and he had previously been a pharmacist. So, you know, there is no age limit. We welcome people into our teacher education programs.
AJ, thanks for the call. Elise joins us now in Madison. Elise, hi.
Hi.
What's your story, Elise?
So after 12 years of teaching in public schools, I sent in my letter of resignation at the end of this school year, even though I don't have anything in place yet. And the way I would explain it to people is that the fear of the unknown is much less than the fear of the known, which is our current public school system. And there's really two big issues that I see right now. The first one is dealing with how I would say nearly every school across the nation even has this claim of valuing relationships, which truly is the backbone of education. But as a high school English teacher, I very routinely had 30 or more students per class. And we can't say that we value relationships if each teacher is responsible for 150 or more students per semester. And then the second thing is cell phone usage. It is something that actually has to be very specifically addressed, especially coming off of pandemic. Students are clinically addicted to their cell phones, and we don't really have any rules about that. And I will never be more interesting than what someone can find on their cell phone. And at any given moment, there would be probably at least 10 students on their cell phones during class, even though our school rule was not to be on cell phones.
Elise, thanks for the call. Diana, Elise pointing toward a couple of in classroom conditions that helped drive her off.
Well, absolutely. We know that a lot of teachers go into teaching because they really want to have strong relationships with young people because that's the way to best teach them. And I think she's absolutely right that the larger class sizes make it much more difficult to create the kind of relationships you need with students in order to be an effective teacher. And I also agree with her that cell phone usage is really a problem. And I've been in schools that have come up with ways of keeping students from using cell phones, and they seem very different to me than schools where teachers are battling what we just heard, where you've got students who are addicted to their cell phones. And, you know, that just is a barrier to learning. So I actually do think we have to take a very, very strong stand against having cell phones in the classroom. And I think there are ways of doing that.
Thanks for that call, Diana. In just our last minute or so, talk about who might be eligible for this Wisconsin Teacher Pledge Program. One thing I think I got a little wrong earlier, it could be somebody who's already a junior in college, say.
Absolutely. So, you know, we have undergraduate teacher education programs, and we've just signed a new agreement with Madison College, where people can go to Madison College for 2 years and then have a guaranteed transfer into our teacher education programs. We're really excited about that, and we're hoping to get a lot of students from Madison College. But there are a number of ways to get into the Teacher Pledge and get into our teacher ed programs. So I really encourage people who are interested to just Google UW-Madison Teacher Pledge. That will take you to information about how you can talk with somebody who can help you think about your specific situation. But I think if we're going to solve the teacher shortage in Wisconsin and across the nation, we're going to have lots of creative ways of attracting people into the field. So, for example, we have a special program with the Madison Metropolitan School District where people who are employed in the school district and have a bachelor's degree, but they're not currently teachers and they want to be teachers, we've created a special program for them.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Diana Hess, Dean of the UW-Madison School of Education. Join us for a look at teacher staffing in Wisconsin and some solutions on the way. Coming up after the news, don't let bad grammar get you down. We'll learn how to avoid some common and tricky language pitfalls with an expert who's traveled the country with her grammar table. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, make some frozen desserts for this week's edition of Food Friday. First, language can be used to connect people, but sometimes language rules can cause confusion and arguments, even among friends, family, and spouses. But help is on the way. Our next guest hit the road and traveled around the country, including here to Wisconsin, to set up a grammar table and answer questions from passerbys, or I guess passersby. She joins us now to share that experience and to tackle some of the funky twists and turns of spelling, punctuation, grammar, and more. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a nagging grammar question? Maybe a dispute you have with a friend or loved one? Is there something that you always stumble over when it comes to spelling something or how to write something or how to punctuate it? You name it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ellen Jovan is the co-founder of a communication skills training consultancy called Syntaxis. She's the author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for letting me take my grammar party inside on this hot day. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. How did you get started as a roving grammarian setting up your grammar advice table?
I wasn't that roving at first. At first, I like grammar, in case that isn't clear yet. And one day I said, hey, I need a grammar table. So I ordered a table, made a sign, and I walked outside my building. There's a little park right there. So I didn't even have to go a full block. And I put it down and I started answering questions. So I roved one block initially, but then I started moving further around the city and eventually around the country.
And people, you set up shop here with your table, and people, it seems like, were really interested. They came up and had conversations and questions and arguments they had on hand. People love to talk about this with you.
They really do. And to me, it's not surprising at all. Sometimes people say, who cares about grammar? No one cares about grammar anymore. And I'm thinking, you need to sit at the table with me for an hour, because people definitely care about it. They love talking about it. They love fake fighting about it. It can be really hilarious. It's this wonderful bonding instrument for conversation.
Let's get a taste of it. You shared an example with us from a grammar table interaction, this one in Milwaukee. So we can get a flavor of what's going on here. Here's a listen.
It's the grammar table. Do you have any grammar questions?
Yes. The use of commas. Both. Commas like to describe stuff, like more than one thing. Like,
if you have a list.
Dark brown hair, blue eyes, red lips, stuff like that.
That was very visually, I can't think of a word right now. You've left the grammar table speechless.
Ah!
So are you asking about the comma before the and, if it's a list of things?
No, how do we use more commas? We choose not to use commas at all, just a stream of consciousness.
Is this the collective familial we, or does we mean your kids?
My kids.
Sounds like this was a lot of fun. And I think a key, Ellen, is that you're not judgy about this at all, as far as I could tell. You wouldn't correct me and say, don't you mean judgmental, Rob?
I definitely wouldn't. I don't feel judgmental at all. I just think to me, this is really fun, and I'll just answer whatever question people have. I don't tackle them when they walk by. If I hear them use the wrong past participle, that's not how this works.
We're talking to Ellen Jovan, author of the new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. She brought her grammar table to almost every state in the country, including Wisconsin, to answer questions for people. And you can join in with your questions, your grammatical conflicts and confusions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Al is with us in Green Bay. Al, hello.
Thanks for taking my call. So my question involves the word unique. I was brought up to believe that unique means one of a kind. Therefore, you would never put a modifier with it. You wouldn't say somewhat unique or kind of unique, because unique means one of a kind. It doesn't mean kind of one of a kind. But in later years, I've had other people try to tell me that unique simply means unusual. What's the ruling?
Al, thanks for the call. Ellen, how unique does something have to be before we can call it unique?
There's so many things that I could say about this, Al. I personally do not modify my unique. I use it as an absolute. So something is unique or not. I think the word is kind of spoiled because, you know, people who promote things like to make things very unique, extremely unique. And after a while, it just stops having the zing that it, you know, for me, it doesn't have much zing anymore. But It is used also by people to mean unusual, and it definitely takes on that meaning for me when they put an adverb in front of it. I just don't happen to do it myself. So, Al, I have your back. I follow your ways, and, you know, the world changes around us, right?
Thanks for that call. And, you know, I always think of the United States Constitution. What are we going to create? A more perfect union, right? And some people, I think, to this day say, well, perfect, you're either perfect or you're not. And how do you get more perfect? But so this kind of question has been around a long time.
I mean, I think I kind of sympathize with the there can be a more perfect or more unique thing. Yeah, because if you have a tiny blue marble, and then you have a somewhat like a twice as big blue marble next to it, you can say that, okay, in the collection of small marbles, that bigger blue one is unique. But what if you then have a green one that's 100 times as big? The gap between them is bigger. And I think that is captured by the language, even though people don't like it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Lexi is with us in Elkhorn. Lexi, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the show. And I really love the title of the guest book. I just want to say that first. That's great. My question is about pleaded versus pled. Like, why do I hear on the radio, he pleaded guilty? I think that's what I hear. And I want, like, my ear wants me to hear pled, like he pled guilty, but I don't hear people say that anymore. So I'm wondering what the difference is. And yeah, my ear just wants to hear that. It's a weird thing. Like, it hurts my ears when I hear pleaded guilty. And I also wanted to know how the guest became a grammar expert. That would be really interesting to me. And thank you.
Lexi, thanks for the call. Yeah, I think pled is right, but it's a really weird sound word, like pled. I don't know. Tackle this first question, Ellen.
Yeah. So this is an example of the kind of thing that I bring out usage books for. You know, so when I set up the table, I always have this big pile of books, and I rely on Brian Garner's book, Garner's Modern English Usage for things like this, because he's a legal lexicographer. So may I just quote him briefly here for Lexi? Pleaded has always been the predominant past tense and past participial form. From the early 1600s, pleaded has appeared much more frequently in print sources than its rivals. Commentators on usage have long preferred it, pouring drops of vitriol onto has pled and has, oh, pled spelled E-A-D in that case. So my ear is used to pled, but you know, this is one of the words actually that I have a little bit of an experiential gap between me and the usage experts on. And there's a whole bunch more on that I won't read to you, but it's more complicated often than people
Interesting.
Think.
Interesting.
And then there was the second part. Oh, how
did you
time?
Become a grammar expert? Yeah, okay. Just give a quick origin story, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. I have taught writing and grammar my entire life. I majored in language and literature types of things. So I have a degree in German and an MA in comparative literature. I have studied 25 languages, well, more than that on my own. And I'm sitting in front of a giant library of grammar books right now. So it's a lifelong obsession.
All right. Let's go back to our callers now. Thanks for that. Becky is with us in Rio. Becky, hi.
Hi. Thanks for the program. It's really interesting. So the word that hurts my ears is the plural of attorney general. I think it used to be attorney generals. Now I always hear attorneys general, and that just sounds awkward to me. Is that correct, or why has it changed?
Ooh, is it correct, and has it changed, Ellen?
I'm not aware of that having changed. I think I can't say for sure what the frequency is of the plural formations unless I go check a database for you. But I've always, my whole life, which has been a little bit, you know, it's longer than average for the planet now. I've always done attorneys general, and I suspect that you just hear both because people are doing both. That's how it often is with language, but I would do attorneys general.
Yeah, because in this case, you think general, oh, that's like a military rank, so you're like the attorney general. But actually, general is a modifier of attorney. Like, you do lots of different stuff. So it's attorneys
exactly.
general. Did I
exactly.
get that right? Excellent.
Yeah, and you say, and I also say mothers-in-law.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would, too, for sure. Thanks. That's a great question at 800-642-1234. Let's go down to Bill in Milwaukee. Bill, hello.
Hello. I have a sentence for you. The Austrian crystal chandelier crashed to the floor below. Now, I was told that the names of countries are always adjectives, but in this one, it's an adverb. I've gotten in fights about this. What do you think?
Fights. Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, I get it. The distinction here is the chandelier Austrian, or is it a type of crystal called Austrian crystal?
Uh-huh.
Bill, may I ask you, how did this even come up? Do you always parse sentences that you encounter?
I gave this to my students as a question on an exam. It was always fun to debate about it, but a guy in a bar really got mad. He said that the names of countries are always adjectives. I said that this one is describing an adjective, which makes it an adverb.
I don't know.
Austrian is an adverb.
I gotcha. Bill, I don't know how much time you've spent in Ellen, but we spent all our time getting into fist fights in bars over grammar and language. Basically,
wow,
do you have a ruling for Bill on this one?
Well, I suspect, you know, it's funny because I grew up with, you know, sort of traditional grammar. I suspect linguists would probably not categorize, I would have to check with my linguist friends. I think they would probably not categorize it as adverbial strictly, but I see the point. I'm going to have to think about that.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot. Keep it calm out there, man. We're talking with grammar and language expert Ellen Jovan about her experiences operating a public grammar advice table around the country. She shares the story in her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something that's always nagged at you about grammar, spelling, punctuation, pronunciation? Do you have a pet peeve or you need something resolved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Ellen Jovin about her new book, Rebel with a Clause, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Let's go back to your many calls at 800-642-1234. We just heard about Austrian Crystal. Now we'll go to Crystal Lake, Illinois with Carol. Carol, hi.
Hi, Rob. I can tell Ellen just loves her job just by that laugh. You can just tell. My query is about literally, and my beloved daughter uses it constantly, and I think, what does she mean? And then I'm seeing it written. A lot of people are using that now. What are they talking about?
Literally is literally everywhere, Ellen.
Don't start trouble here. Yeah, I mean, so when people say literally X happened and it didn't actually happen, it's a kind of hyperbolic statement. So I get it. Like I might say, oh my gosh, my head exploded when I heard that. And my head didn't actually explode. So I think that's kind of the idea behind the literally as non-literally supporting. That's that argument. I personally don't do that particular one. I exaggerate in many other ways.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Ellen, it seems like a lot of people have that pet peeve, that one or two or maybe 50 language things that bug them a lot.
It's true. And I actually think it serves various social functions that we probably can't quite grasp when we're busy arguing about them. I mean, so first of all, you often have peevers, like people who have peeves that they want to peeve about. And then you have peevers about peevers, who are the peevers who complain about the peevers. Well, no, they're not peevers. They peeve about the peevers, which is a form of peeving. And it's kind of like this cycle. And it's sort of what I like about it is that even when people get annoyed, it doesn't usually come to fist fights. And I think there's a certain catharsis and a bonding thing in it, as long as it's not too mean. I don't like the mean-spirited peeving.
And we can say peever and peeving and to peeve. That's
I
all
mean,
cool.
I made up two words already this afternoon. So
yeah, I do it all the time too.
To ask if you want strict rules about that.
Thanks again for the call. Mike is with us next in Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have, I guess, a pet peeve, too, when people say things like between you and I, and I know it should be between you and me. And I actually had a boss at work. I almost got into an argument with her, but I knew better, you know, than to try to argue with my boss about it. But I said between you and me, and, yeah, she corrected me. It's between you and I, Mike.
Uh-oh. So. Right. Mike, thanks a lot for that. It gets tricky, though, Ellen, because depending on where it is in a sense, like you and I are having a conversation, but this land was made for you and me. And then I don't know, it's easy to start second guessing you and
Rob,
me.
That was so beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
May I respond?
Yeah, yeah.
Comment? Do I have time?
Definitely. Oh, we got lots of time.
Okay. So I actually was in an interview. I teach grammar courses to adults. So I was in an interview with a company where I was going to teach grammar courses for their employees. This was almost 20 years ago. And I said, you can feel free to call Brant or me. That's my partner, or me. And then the person interviewing me asked about it because she thought it was wrong. And I explained it. And then I did not get that job. And the point of this is that there is grammar and then there's the politics of grammar.
Oh, well, I hope you got a better job after that with somebody more grammatically understanding. Thanks again for calling Ellen and me. We'll go next to Becky in Whitefish Bay. Becky, hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I love this program. I love this topic right now. I have taught English language learners for almost 20 years. And the thing that gets to me is when people say conversate instead of converse. I've always thought it was converse, and I think that people say conversate maybe as default because of conversation.
Huh.
But That really irks me.
Becky, Ellen, I don't think I've encountered conversate all that often. Have you?
Oh, many, many times. It's really common. But, you know, I have talked to a lot of people
True.
About these things. Yeah, there are often coexisting forms of verbs, and some of them are more common, or of words generally, not just of verbs, and that some are more common in certain dialects than in others. So I hear that among some demographics and less among others. And I don't say it, but I've gotten used to it. And I think it's always when there's a clash in a word that we use a lot or hear a lot, there's always a little clash in our brain as we process it. So I just wish for peace for you.
Becky, thanks a lot for that call. I'm conversating with Ellen Jovin. Her new book is called Rebel with the Claws, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Katie is with us now in Eau Claire. Katie, hello.
Good afternoon. I have a question about the word memoir and when somebody has written a collection of their life stories, is it their memoirs or have they written a memoir?
Oh, they both sound vaguely right to me, Ellen. What's the deal?
You're the first person who's ever asked me about that.
Huh.
I wrote my memoir. I mean, I think my default is singular, but I would actually have to investigate the history of that one to be certain. I try to be very responsible in the information dispensed from the grammar table. So, by the way, Rob, I'm going to also be posting on my Twitter account about the Austrian crystal question, because I think traditional grammarians will say adverb and the not and linguists will say something else. So I will also bring this one up there because this is fun for my grammar table language polls.
Excellent. All right. I will look for that later. Time for another call or two. Drew is with us in Grafton. Drew, hi. Are you there, Drew? Not hearing Drew. Let's try Victoria in Menominee. Victoria, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Victoria?
My biggest pet peeve is when people say ax instead of ask. I would just like to slap them.
Victoria, thanks for the call. Now, there are a lot of words where kind of, vowel or consonants will flip-flop, like, nuclear, axe instead of ask. What do you think about that one, Ellen?
Yeah, there's actually a long history for that kind of thing where you see that flipping. That's not an area of expertise for me. That's more a linguist's domain. I believe John McWhorter, the linguist, has written about that, but it actually goes back a lot longer than people think, and has affected language in more ways, I suspect, than we realize. It's also part of African American vernacular, so you might hear it more there. So it's also, within certain groups, you hear certain things more than others. I grew up near the Valley in the 80s in Los Angeles. So there are things that I am doing right now that are probably annoying people, and they may write to me about it afterwards.
Thanks for the call, Victoria. Todd is with us now, calling from north of Toma. Todd, hello.
Hi there. I was calling about the terms data and datum. And data, to me, is a plural term. So the data are compelling, but I hear it actually on NPR a fair amount, where people use data as a singular.
Todd, great question. You cover this in the book, Ellen. I try to write around it, so I never say data is or data are. I just change the damn sentence. What do you think?
I love this topic. I love all the grammar topics that intersect a little bit with mathy kinds of things. I love that extra. Somehow I haven't noticed that catching on as much with some other people, but I love it. Data came into English as a plural and datum came in as the singular, but here's reality for me. I cannot remember ever in my life hearing someone say datum, except maybe in some kind of scientific analysis. Data is used as a plural countable noun, but it is also used as a synonym for information generally. So the further you are away from a quantitative analysis with data points, the more likely you are to hear it as a singular. And I consider both acceptable.
Thanks for everybody's calls. And Ellen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I loved it.
That's Ellen Jovan, author of the new book, Rebel with the Claws, Tales and Tips from a Roving Grammarian. Coming up after the news, when the weather gets hot, don't bake. Make some frozen desserts on this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll keep it cool with ice cream and other sweet treats. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time.